I'm Martha Plimpton in for Leonard Lopate. Have you ever wondered why we humans are so drawn to animals? According to renowned veterinarian and veterinary behaviorist Dr. Vint Virga, by viewing the world through animal eyes, we may better understand our own behavior. In his new book, The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human, Dr. Virga draws on his 30 years of experience treating wild, domestic, and exotic animals. He's also been a special guest on ABC World News, National Geographic Explorer, and PBS Nature. The book is published by Crown, and I am very pleased that it brings Dr. Vint Virga to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Oh, good. I'm glad you're here. And if you want to call in our dear and valued audience with questions or comments, give us a call at 212-433-9692 and tell us your stories or your experiences with your animals. Or you can go to our show page at WNYC.org or tweet us at Leonard Lopate. What draws us to animals? What is it? What's the thing, do you think, Vint, that makes us so mysteriously connected to them?
Well, I think we share so much in common with them. And I think we see because of that, we see reflections of ourselves in them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really no different in my eyes than the reasons we're drawn to another person. We find a chemistry with certain animals, whether they're a dog and cat in our family, or I was just wandering in the zoo yesterday and watching people. There's a connection that people will find with certain creatures, and we see something of ourselves in them, and that is what ultimately I think is underlying that chemistry.
Haven't prominent figures in history sort of believed that our souls are connected to animal souls?
Oh, absolutely. There's been popes, philosophers, writers, historians that have felt that animals have souls, much like ours. And yet it's still, throughout the millennia, still tends to be this controversial issue.
Even though the Latin root of the word animal speaks to this, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Explain about that.
Well, animal is derived from the word animus, and animus mm-hmm. actually means the vital force or soul of a living being.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as we feel like we're privileged having souls, we're looking at essence at our animus or our soul within us.
Right.
It's not surprising, then, therefore, that animals also have a soul.
How do you think we humans benefit from seeing the world as animals do? What can we get out of it?
Well, Martha, I think we get caught so much in our human existence. We look at the ways in which we operate in our daily lives, and we have so much craziness about our lives, and we have so many tasks, we have so many things that we need to do in our lives, in our day-to-day roles, that we forget about our highest priorities. Animals that I work with, whether they're in zoos or in private practice, remind me constantly that they are living in the present moment, whereas we're most of the time, as the Buddhists would say, hanging out in the past and worrying about the future.
So you were actually an emergency room clinician for 4 years.
I was.
Out of veterinary school when you just had what you describe in your book as a profoundly moving experience. What was that experience and how did it change you?
So there was a dog that I was working with. It was a stormy November night, as I recall. And this dog that I was working with, it was a typical night in the emergency room. So we had tons of animals coming in. And right at the height of the first waves of patients, this one flat-coated retriever was whisked into the back of the hospital, straight into the treatment room, which usually isn't a great sign. Usually mm-hmm. that means that they take priority. Triage is saying that we got to work on them first.
Mm-hmm.
And this dog had been hit by a car. I started my exam worrying about shock and seeing a dog that for all intents and purposes, wasn't going to be around for too much longer. So we began our resuscitation efforts. And as I started working more and more with him, what I saw is there was really nothing physically wrong with him. I couldn't find a thing. There was nothing wrong with his vital signs. I couldn't find any evidence of fractures or internal bleeding. We did x-rays. We did blood work. And everything seemed to be saying that this dog was perfectly fine. So I got him stabilized, and I had to go on to all my other patients that I was seeing that night. And it wasn't until, I'd say about 2 in the morning when everybody had left, and there I am exhausted, that I was finally able to really sit down and be with him longer. I check in on him and the technicians, or now and then during the night. So I was exhausted. I sat down in the run next to him, next to his blankets that he was laying on, and I started working on my charts. And absentmindedly, while one arm's draped on his chest, I'm sitting there writing my records, and I notice that he started becoming more and more responsive. And within the course of an hour, that dog became a fully normal dog for all intents and purposes.
He sort of came back to life in a way.
Yeah.
And how did that change the way you looked at your relationships with people as well as with animals?
Well, I started questioning, all the years I'd been in vet school with our medical training and the pre-med curriculum. Everything's so much based on the science and the methodology and the practice. And yeah, there's an art to medicine, but I started realizing just how critical that bond is, that relationship is that we have with animals, and how much it can impact them. Mm-hmm. Afterwards, of course, with how much it impacted me, seeing how he recovered, that's what really changed the course of my career.
Do you have extraordinary stories about your special bond with an animal? We're taking your calls, your questions, your comments at 212-433-9692. I'm Martha Plimpton, and I'm here for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Dr. Vint Virka, the author of the book, The Soul of All Living Creatures, What Animals Can Teach Us About Being Human. So what does your job as a veterinary behaviorist entail? Do you mostly do research, or do you see patients? What
I see patients. Now, for years, I saw only dogs and cats in their homes, occasionally a bird or another creature. And somewhere along the line, I can't even tell you when, without looking back, I had an opportunity to start working with a zoo case and a bug bit. And so as the course of my career continued, I started doing more and more zoo work. Eventually, I left the small animal cases to other veterinary behaviorists, and now I strictly do zoo behavior work. So I travel around from zoo to zoo, and I help the zoos with specific issues relating to the animals that they have in their care.
Mm-hmm. And what's the most unusual animal you think you've ever treated?
Oh, gosh. Wow, that's tough. I imagine if you asked me that every day, it would probably be something different. Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm thinking of 2 Tawkins that are actually brothers. A Tawkin is...
what is that? What's a Tawkin?
They look a little bit like a...
Do they look anything like a toucan?
No, not even close. They're the national animal of Bhutan, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. And they look like a cross between a wildebeest and an antelope and an oxen, I guess I would say. Mm-hmm. They kind of look a little bit, if you look at them from the front end, like a wildebeest that has been severely bitten by a bunch of wasps. They have a very large, broad face. And they're the most, right now, they don't sound maybe like the most exotic creatures, but they're pretty.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd want to spend a lot of time with them.
And they're not exactly used to people. They tend to be rather... standoffish to people, but these two brothers I'm particularly fond
that
of.
That sounds fascinating. Denise in New Jersey has had a horse she wanted to talk about. Hi, Denise.
Hi. I wanted to just add to your wonderful conversation about the tremendous connections that we have with horses. I'd gotten a horse many years ago and was so attached to him that when I would pull up to the barn in my car, I knew when something was wrong with him before I'd ever laid eyes on him. And one day in particular, I had this feeling, this sinking feeling, and I knew something was wrong. And by the time I got to his stall, I looked at his face, and I could tell that something horrible had happened. And when I took him out of the stall, he was literally walking on three legs because the farrier had put a nail more to the heel of his foot and his whole leg was swollen. And I knew it before I'd even gotten out of my car. That's how connected emotionally that I was to this animal.
Do you see that?
I just wanted to contribute that.
Thank you, Denise. That's fascinating. Do you see that in your practice, Dr. Virga?
Oh, absolutely. And it doesn't even have to be with my clients with family pets. It's just as much true with the keepers in zoos and the animals in their care. I think what we're also picking up on in situations like that is not just our connection with them, but we're also picking up on all the signals that we don't really give us credit for having as human beings. Mm-hmm. We give animals credit for those types of special senses, but we really have them. We just tend to shove them aside and dismiss them and go, what am I thinking of?
Elliot in Connecticut says his dog had been in a terrible mauling. Elliot, what happened with your dog?
Well, my German Shepherd had been mauled by two pit bulls and, quite a bit of damage. And I think what caught me was the discussion about sitting next to the dog that the doctor had in the run. Because I ended up nursing this animal from morning till night. It was a 24-hour affair for at least 2 weeks. And I was so amazed at how the attention that he got from not only myself but a couple of other people through this process, his recovery, you would not have even known about 4 weeks later that this animal had been mauled. It was just incredible. And so many other people had said the same thing, that the amount of love and attention, it just moves the needle in a direction that was amazing.
And it's true for humans, too, isn't it?
Oh. Yeah, I agree. You're absolutely right. And
yeah.
I think that,
yeah,
so,
absolutely.
I mean, I heard this and I said, wow, I experienced something so similar.
Yeah. Mm. Thank you, Elliot. That's extraordinary. We use animals, often dogs, cats, as therapy animals very frequently because of not only the fact that touching and caressing them can help us and make us feel better, but often some of these animals have been in their own traumatic situations too, haven't they?
Absolutely.
And there's some kind of empathy relationship going on.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Are there misconceptions, though, do you think, about that we sometimes have about what animals think and feel? You write that one misconception about dogs, for example, is that all dogs should enjoy being around other dogs. And if for some reason they don't, there's something wrong with them. But some dogs can maybe just be antisocial, just as humans can.
Well, I think that some are more social than others. There's plenty of dogs I've met that like their particular small circle of other dogs. There's so many misconceptions out there, and that's one of the fun things I had in writing the book, is trying to dispel some of the misconceptions. For example, a commonly heard one that I hear, there isn't a week that goes by when I don't hear it several times, is he's the alpha dog.
Right.
I hear it not only in relation to dogs.
Is there any such thing?
There is no such thing.
Really?
I hear
that'll
it
come as news to a lot of people.
Absolutely. There are such things as leaders, but dogs do not go about in real life situations asserting themselves in order to dominate others. This inherent tendency to feel like we've got to label something as an alpha, some animal as an alpha, is actually much more a reflection about us and our humanity than it is about the dogs, leopards, or other animals that we see.
If you have comments or a story about your own animal, give us a call at 212-433-9692. I'm speaking with veterinarian Vint Virga about the inner lives of animals. His book is called The Soul of All Living Creatures. It's published by Crown, and we'll have more after the break. And on the next Fresh Air, novelist Kate Christensen on her memoir, Blue Plate Special. Also, health writer Joe Robinson explains why we'd be better off eating a little more like our prehistoric ancestors. That's coming up today at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC. I'm Martha Plimpton in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Hi, I'm Martha Plimpton, in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Dr. Vint Virga, all about the inner lives of animals. And we're taking your calls. Let's see. Antonia from New Jersey, you had an interesting question about how we choose our animals. Go ahead.
My question, Doctor, is this. Obviously, many of these animals have been selectively bred. I mean, the dog is the classic example. Is it possible that in our selective breeding, we have actually adopted traits or basically foster traits that aid the communication between the animal and us? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you so much.
I
called him Antonio, but I think it might have been an Anthony. Either way, thanks for the call. What do you think, Dr. Virga?
I think he's spot on. The truth is that we've selected for, if we want to look at dogs specifically, we've selected for these breeds not only for traits with respect to hunting or field work or whatever we might use them mm-hmm. for companionship, but we've also co-opted them for certain traits that we find attractive. Mm-hmm. It's a well-known fact that different behavioral traits are more prevalent in certain breeds of dogs. Mm-hmm. I think that it's natural then that each of us is going to be drawn to certain breeds of dogs, and what I might be drawn to could be very different than somebody else might be drawn to.
Britt in Tuckahoe has a cat named Steve, and I just love that name for a cat. I love human names for cats. I once knew a cat named Kevin, and I thought that was hilarious. But tell us, Britt, about your cat named Steve.
Well, Steve had a sister. It was Steve Aniti, actually.
Oh, so. Even better.
Yes, and sadly, Edie passed away when she was 10, but Steve lasted a good long time, and he was 19, almost 20 years old. He was not doing so well, and I kind of was thinking this might be the time he needed to be put down, but I went out of town, and before I left, I literally said to the cat, please do not pass away while I'm gone, wait till I get back. And he did. He greeted me at the door when I got back. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. By 6 o'clock, the little guy was wobbly on his legs. 10 o'clock, could not stand up. And in the morning, my husband and I had found he had passed away, and he'd stayed nearby. He was in, you know, the bed with us, so, which is very unusual for a cat. So we're convinced he was always a very empathetic cat, loved everybody, and I think he took my request.
That's extraordinary. You guys had a very strong bond. Thank you, Britt. Some people I've heard say that their animals wait until they leave to pass. I guess it doesn't, you know, it just sort of depends on the animal, huh?
I think it depends on the animal and their family and what's going on with them. So what happened, I think, with Steve Aniti, it's certainly possible. I do want to say that cats, leopards, it doesn't matter what species we're talking about, a felid, and as well as any other, they understand human words. Now, I can't say for certain that Steve understood exactly what her request was, but animals are able to pick up so much more about our human feelings than what we tend to pick up
on. It's true.
So one way or the other, I have no doubt Steve got the message.
So animals, you think, are receptive to people's feelings?
Oh, absolutely.
How much of our emotions do you think they really understand?
I think they understand our emotions. Sometimes I wonder
better than we do.
Yes.
I don't doubt that, actually. Do you think some animals are more receptive than others?
Oh, absolutely.
Well, there was a recent study, I shouldn't bring it up because I can't cite it, but where I read that dogs are the only domesticated animal that can understand when you're indicating something by pointing or looking at it. That dogs have somehow had this communication skill bred into them. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I don't. I
think it's true, though. I'm just going to take a stab and say that it's true. And
I'm thinking of all the zoo creatures I deal with, from red pandas to clouded leopards to camels. A main way in which the keepers that are the primary people responsible for caring for them, the main way they communicate to them a lot of times is through hand signals and pointing.
So
I need to see that study to see what they were talking about.
I'm probably reading it wrong. I said I shouldn't have brought it up. Okay, Mary in Brooklyn, what's going on?
Hi. Well, I was calling about my cat, Harry, who he was kind of a loner, only responded to me in general, and had never been out of my apartment since he was fixed. And he was about 10 years old, and he needed his teeth cleaned, so we took him in, and they kept him overnight. And the next day, the vets called, and we've been going to them forever, and they knew me, and they said, no, we're concerned he's unresponsive. He's just not responding. We want to keep him another night. And then it was a third night, and I just knew he had to come home. So I went and I picked him up, and he was just, oh, it was a dead weight in the cat carrier. He was completely unresponsive. By the time I got him home, I was so concerned. I thought maybe this was a mistake. Maybe he should have stayed. And I opened my apartment door, and my dog and my other cat were waiting at the door. And as soon as he heard them or smelled them, he put both his little paws through the cat carrier.
Aww.
And started meowing.
You should have seen Dr. Virga's face just now when you said, as soon as my other dogs. Anyway, go on, go on.
And I opened the carrier. He jumped out. He went right to his food. He went right to the litter box.
Oh, he was missing his buddies.
Yeah, it was a miracle. I mean, it was just like, it was, I mean, the vet was so concerned, I had to sign a waiver. But she was like, I just, you know, we've never seen anything like it just for a teeth cleaning. He was only 10, but it was so heartwarming. And he lasted for another 6 years. And
fantastic.
He was just an amazing cat. And he passed away in my arms, I think because he didn't ever want to go back to the vet ever again.
Yeah. I don't blame him.
It was a really peaceful, he didn't suffer. He was just old, but it was just really something to see that. Like, I sensed what he needed, and he completely responded to it. And
that's wonderful.
He was fine.
Thank you, Mary. That's a great story. I guess animals not only have bonds with us, they have bonds with the other animals in their households, too.
Oh, certainly, certainly.
Mm-hmm. So there was a Barnard College study. This one I have some information on. It's not as vague as the one I previously mentioned. So this study revealed that the guilty face, you know, the guilty face that dogs put on after getting caught, you know, if they have an accident in the house or they get caught eating garbage, that actually... that guilty face has nothing to do with guilt. Why do they make those faces then?
Oh, that's another one of those beautiful misconceptions.
Okay.
And I hear it all the time that people, well, he knows he's not supposed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
What our dog knows is that we get upset when we find that they've done that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So what they're doing is, if you want to look at it scientifically, what they're doing is an appeasement behavior, which means that what they're doing is saying to us, I know you're not happy. It might have to do with this, or they might not get what it has to do with.
Mm-hmm.
If it was hours before, they might, but they know one way or the other, we're not happy. And what they're saying is, okay, what do we need to do to get past this?
Right.
And that is a huge lesson. It's one of the lessons I draw in the book, that animals basically know how to forgive, to give as before, without sitting there and holding on to this negativity and needing to do this all the rigmarole that we tend to do as people.
Because they're living completely in the moment.
In the moment.
And which is why if you're, and I'm just going to guess this, if you're attempting to train your dog not to do a certain behavior like eating the garbage or whatever, you don't want to wait a long time, and you certainly don't want to do it violently, but you want to send the message that you disapprove as it's happening. Is that fair to say?
Yes. If you are going to try to convince them or
correct
a behavior,
then
you need to catch it actually in process or within a few seconds of it. But then punishment is not the way to go about doing it. It's simply through correction and redirection.
Right.
Yeah.
So speaking of being right in the moment, John in Paramus wants to know something. Go ahead, John.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, sort of.
Oh, good. I admire your work, by the way. But getting to the question, the dogs realize the passage of time. You know, I've heard that if you're gone for a day or if you're gone for the week, they really don't realize that it's a long week or two or three days. It's a long time. They just
Live
in the moment.
They live in the moment. That's a good question, John.
Yes, dogs certainly have a strong appreciation for time. I've got a great story around that that just came to mind.
Oh, but we're out of time.
Oh.
Can you believe that, Dr. Virga? I'm so sorry. The time just flew. I've been speaking with veterinarian Vint Virga about the inner lives of animals. I want to hear that story later. His book is called The Soul of All Living Creatures. It's published by Crown. Vint, it's been such a pleasure. And listen, buy the book because maybe the story's in there. Thank you, Doctor, so much.
Mm-hmm.